Welcome to Warriors for Peace. This weekly broadcast honors the men and women from different countries and cultures who have served and fought in various ways for the peace and rights that freedom brings. There are those also who serve daily to help preserve peace and the rights that come with freedom. I call these individuals Warriors for Peace. This is Donna Sebo, and I will be your host for the next hour. In the daily news, we often are hearing about countries around the world. We hear about diplomats that are working in different environments. We really are pretty ignorant about history and about how certain environments of change create enemies, create friends and alliances. My guest today, Christopher Kelly, who is calling in from London, put together, along with an associate, Stuart Laycock, America Invades. When I read this publication, my eyes were opened to so many aspects of history that most people wouldn't even have a clue about. And that's what we're going to be discussing today on Warriors for Peace. When you have the time to understand history, many times you are made aware of why certain conflicts evolved, what it is that has created the triggers for war and also for peace. Christopher Kelly, I want to welcome you to the show.
Donna, great to be with you today.
My pleasure. We've chatted before, and your love of history is just absolutely amazing, and your patience at doing the research is even more amazing. Now, you're the former chairman of the Siron Corporation, and you used to be in television as an executive. You have this passion for military history, and a number of your family members have been in American wars. And you find this so engaging. Do you think it was because of your family history that you yourself decided that you were going to evolve into becoming a historian, along with Stuart Laycock, to put out this book?
Well, I think that my family had a lot to do with it. My father was a veteran, was in the U.S. Army during the Korean War. He didn't serve in Korea, but he was actually based in France. I think I mentioned it briefly in the France chapter that he happened to be there during the Korean War. I had a number of other ancestors going back, you know, even to the American Revolution and even to the War of 1812 that served. And I mentioned a couple of them in the course of the book as well. So yeah, I was able to integrate some of my family history. And then, of course, as you mentioned, I have a co-author, Stuart Laycock, who had written a book earlier, which came out in 2012, called All the Countries We've Invaded, which was about how Britain invaded 90% of all the countries in the world. And he went through with chapter by chapter, with a chapter on every country from Afghanistan to Zimbabwe, talking what Britain had done, you know, here, there, and everywhere. And I reviewed his book. We met in a pub in London. We became friends. And I said, as an American, I'm curious to see how America compares to Britain. We don't have quite as much history, but we have certainly been active around the world recently as a global superpower, and we remain active today, of course, militarily with bases around the world, too.
In America Invades, which, by the way, for those listening, 5% of the sales goes to working with military, goes to military charities. I was astonished to find that in our short history as a nation, we've invaded or fought in 84 out of 194 countries. Now, these are countries recognized by the United Nations. That you say that's 43% of the total. That is incredible.
That's right. So, Britain, with, according to Stu's book, invaded or fought in 90% of all the world. We're not, the United States is by no means at 90%. We're more around 44% of all the countries in the world, though, we have fought in at some point in our history. And the history that goes back, we went all the way back to, you know, we tracked the very first American military involvement, which I think is surprising, is 1741. In an area that today is Colombia in South America, which I think might be interesting to talk about. But you have, you know, in invasions and Americans fighting around the world going back into the 18th century, right up until, you know, things that happened, you know, almost last year, so to speak, very recent events, and American involvement in places like Africa. We're more deeply involved in Africa today than ever before in our history, for example. So, yeah.
That is true. You make a statement that Americans are always hoping for peace, but usually preparing for war. Boy, we're hearing the war drums beating even now. I don't know that they've stopped beating for years. The American eagle, you say, is an ambivalent bird holding arrows in the talons of one foot and an olive branch in the other. I've had other guests say that about the American attitude. The American attitude is, let's not get engaged in other people's business unless it affects us in some way. Let's leave well enough alone. And then all of a sudden, like with World War II, when the Japanese bombed us, it's full steam ahead and we rally. And I thought that was a very interesting perspective, and you concur with that.
Right. I do. And I think about, there's a guy named Charles Sumner who was a senator from Massachusetts, and he was very much, during the Mexican-American War, he lived in the 19th century, he was a kind of an ardent pacifist, and he strongly disapproved of the Mexican-American War in the 1840s, and he basically said that war is murder. But then you fast forward a few years, and he's actually, he was actually attacked on the floor of the Capitol building in Washington, D.C., by a he'd given a speech about abolition. He was in favor of abolition of slavery, and he was beaten by a congressman from South Carolina, which some people call it the opening blows of the United States Civil War. Sumner went on to be in Lincoln's cabinet, and he became an ardent proponent for war. So here he was, a guy who was very much a pacifist, who didn't believe in war, but then he becomes an ardent supporter of the Union cause in the course of the Civil War. So sometimes, it isn't just that there are hawks and doves. Sometimes, you know, doves become hawks, and vice versa, too, I suppose.
Well, I think that has been very obvious, especially since 9/11. Affected us in this country. I know that there are those that have declared themselves pacifists, and then they did a absolute turnaround saying, no, this is not permitted. So it's what you've said is very valid. I want to start off, because you have all of these countries in here. How long did it take you and Stuart to put all of this together? The information in here is just amazing.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It was about a 2-year project of putting it together, and that when the book came out in 2014, we're thinking about, you know, updating it at some point, because, of course, you know, there have been things that have happened since it came out. A few things like Niger we've been involved with, and of course there's the possibility of future editions too, with who knows where we might be involved with next. So kind of a stay tuned, I suppose, with it too. It can be, it might be a work in progress, but we brought it up to date to 2014 and tracked. We'd had two categories. We'd had invasions. We defined basically as Americans fighting in a foreign country, armed Americans fighting in a foreign country. Sometimes that was usually that's with the United States government, but sometimes there were instances where Americans fought, you know, without, or sometimes you know, in opposition to our government too. So we defined invasions with the 44% number, with about I believe there were almost 90 countries that we'd fought in directly, and then we added the category of military involvements, which is not fighting, but it's significant military involvement. I mean, an example of that is like Portugal, for example. We Americans have not invaded Portugal, but we've had bases on the Azores, which is a Portuguese possession in the Atlantic, since World War II, which were set up to fight against German submarines in the Atlantic, and we still have those bases to this day. I mean, we have air and naval bases in the Azores that Americans use, military forces use to this day.
That's true. And also you bring out the humanitarian efforts. This is something right. I don't think many Americans are aware of, and other people in the world. I think of the humanitarian efforts in China, in Russia, mm-hmm. in yep. the Middle East, in Africa. The military and Americans in general have been deeply involved in much of this activity. But right now, let's start off with the very first country that you mention in your book, and that is Afghanistan. That sure. tiny little country historically has been, I'm surprised it's still alive and even functioning, because
right.
there's
right.
China on one side, you have India on the other, and you have all of these different factions throughout their history. This is like a right. landlocked piece of country. This is something that their history and the involvement of America in Afghanistan, my goodness, that one little tiny country can produce a topic of conversation that can get rather heated as to whether we should be there or not be there.
Sure.
Let's chat about what you discovered about Afghanistan.
Well, absolutely. Afghanistan, you know, is the first in the alphabet, and there's the first chapter we wrote about, and of course, it's a very tough chapter. I mean, the war in Afghanistan is the longest American war in history. I mean, that we have had American troops in there since shortly after 9/11, when they went in, and they're there to this day, and here we are, coming up on 17 years later. And so you have, men and women who are serving in Afghanistan today who might have been toddlers at the time of 9/11. And you've never had a war of that, an American war of that duration, of going from 17 years. I mean, you can imagine if after Pearl Harbor was in 1941, if Pearl Harbor were still being fought in 1956, I mean, imagine the changes that in technology and in all kinds of, in the world, in the course of 16 years. But, you know, we are still fighting in Afghanistan, and, I mean, it's cost trillions of dollars and many lives, of course. And Afghanistan has this ancient history of being what they call the graveyard of empires. I mean, mm-hmm. that Alexander the Great invaded Afghanistan. The British famously invaded and kind of disastrously invaded Afghanistan. And then, of course, the Russians in the 70s, the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan, and it kind of became the Russian Vietnam, I suppose you could call it. So it was a kind of a bleeding ulcer for communism, for the Soviet Union, when they went into Afghanistan in the late 70s. So it has this kind of long history, and it's, of course, a very highly mountainous area. The terrain is incredibly, you know, difficult, and provides lots of places for guerrilla fighters to kind of hide out and take refuge in, which, of course, has been the case in this recent conflict as well.
Oh, yes, very, very much so. And also, the United States got involved with Pakistan, which is,
yes.
you know, right there, and their intelligence service, the ISI. You go into this
right.
detail, and wars are extraordinarily expensive. There's no way of getting around it. And
right.
this is Afghanistan also. I'm trying to remember the mineral. There is something that Afghanistan has. It's deeply desired. So it's a little tiny landlocked country, but it's...
Well, of course, it has opium. It has, of course, the poppy.
Yes, the poppy, but there was some other mineral, too, that was there. And
sure.
I don't remember which one it was right at the moment. I think it starts with a letter L. I want to say lithium, but I don't think that's mm-hmm. correct.
Sure.
But there is... They've always been in this environment, and... Here we go. Well, then you go into, again, so many different countries, but I think of Bosnia and Herzegovina. This,
right. mm-hmm.
you know, you have this area as well. And they have a tremendous agitated history as well.
Right. Right. Sure, the Balkans definitely do. You know, it's funny you mentioned the Bosnian Herzegovina. I just happened this past weekend. I met with the Prince and Princess of Serbia, actually, who live in Belgrade in Serbia today. And so, but of course, the Serbia and the Balkans have had a very tumultuous history. Have been kind of a place where a powder keg that ignites wars. I mean, certainly they did in World War I with the assassination of the Archduke that led to the outbreak of World War I. So, much more recently, Europe has been, since World War II, Europe has been, surprisingly peaceful.
Mm-hmm.
But with the one exception of Yugoslavia, the breakup of Yugoslavia, where, of course, there was a war that was fought in the 90s, and a very, a bitter war that was fought before they finally were able to get Slobodan Milosevic out. The Balkans is a tricky area, and of course there are. I mean, of course, Afghanistan has been a difficult area as well.
Very much so. Now, when I got to Bulgaria, I was absolutely astonished when I found out that two particular facts. Radio Free Europe was financed by the CIA, and the Voice of America was broadcasting into Russia in 1947. Now, someone may say, Donna, wait a minute. You just mentioned Bulgaria. Why is this significant? Bulgaria was a very significant part in World War II, wasn't it?
Right. There you go. In the Balkans, of course, with Bulgaria. I think many Americans might be surprised that we had a military involvement with Bulgaria and that we actually, what was happening is that we were, Romania and Bulgaria were Axis allies, were allied to the Nazis, and there were significant oil fields in Romania that were supplying oil to the German panzers, and that was a very strategically important target for us to bomb, which meant that we had a lot of American pilots and air crews flying over Bulgaria and Romania, and some of them were shot down, and so we had these POWs that we were concerned with, and so we sent these raids into Romania and the Balkans to try to rescue operations to rescue the downed airmen. There were these POWs, so that was kind of one of our military involvements in Bulgaria that I thought was interesting in that particular chapter.
There's all of these unique points of information that you bring out with Bulgaria. That was it was astonishing to me to find out that the Tennessee National Guard is partnered with Bulgaria. Now, before we started the program this morning, I found that I made that comment to you about how frequently the National Guard in various states in the United States have adopted different countries. And you mentioned that the state of Washington, which I am in, the National Guard here at the state of Washington adopted Thailand.
That's right. That's right. It's almost like you think of it like a sister city program or something like that, in the sense that it's an exchange program where you have people, like in Washington State is partnered with Thailand, so you have Thai soldiers that come occasionally to train and to study American military tactics and doctrine in Washington State. And then by the same token, you have soldiers from the National Guard in Washington that go to Thailand to visit there as well, to kind of exchange, information on best practices, that type of thing, and on technology. And I mean, the ways, obviously, the technology of war changes, of course, and evolves, and there are, concerns. And National Guards, of course, get involved in, you mentioned humanitarian issues. I mean, National Guards often are called out to provide humanitarian relief in emergencies. I mean, we saw that this past year with all of the terrible storms that affected Texas, Florida, and different parts of the country. And of course, National Guard is kind of like the first call that a governor makes to try to address an emergency. democracy in their home state.
Absolutely true. Cambodia. This, to me, is heartbreaking. I am well aware of the genocide that was done by Pol Pot. I've done interviews on it. Over 2 million people were murdered. It was a vast genocide dictated by one man. And finally, he was driven into exile. He was never executed, and he died. But the hideousness of what those poor people in Cambodia have gone through, it's just amazing. And, of course, war, the Vietnam War, overlapped into that area. And we dropped more than 540,000. That's beyond my comprehension in a way. Tons of explosives in Cambodia. And then Congress cut off the funds for supplying that kind of, what do I want to say, bombs in 1973. But you go in again to so much detail, even though you've compressed the detail, it still is very succinct, and it makes us aware of how war impacts us and how, as a nation, many times we are called into situations to bring relief. Sometimes we are participants in the ugliness of it. And you and Stuart brought both aspects of this out, which I really deeply respected. Now, one of the countries I want to talk about, too, and of course we all know about China, and there's all kinds of opinions about China, but we've been integrated with China for generations. I mean, this is something we've had an alliance, an association, sometimes good, sometimes not so good, in China for a long time.
Absolutely. I mean, that's very true. I mean, we had advisors to Chiang Kai-shek during World War II. There were, I mean, Claire Chennault went over, the Flying Tigers were supportive of, and of course, we were supportive in terms of money, but also in terms of you know, pilots and in all kinds of ways with nationalist China. And I mean, we have, and even before World War II, I mean, even in the Boxer Rebellion at the start of the 20th century, 1900, there were American soldiers that were participating in and actually fighting in China. And in fact, there's a American infantry division. I believe it might be the 15th. I think I mentioned it in here in the book. It's the 15th Infantry Regiment. Actually, they were involved in the Boxer Rebellion at the start of the 20th century. And as a result today, and they still exist, they're still a unit in the U.S. Army, and they have a dragon patch on their and as part of their kit. And so I mean, like, you have a Chinese symbol on an American Army unit, which I think is interesting. I mean, that's a legacy of our involvement with China going back, you know, so many years.
Now, Mao was someone that had a very, very negative effect, the Cultural Revolution. I have met with and talked with people who survived the Cultural Revolution, where their families did not. To this day, we do not know really how many people were killed in that in that mass slaughter. That's exactly what it was. And Mao followed the dictates of what Stalin did in many respects. And that changed, you might say, the culture dramatically on a political level. And China had gone through a lot of invasion by the Japanese. And you bring this out. And so China itself, as a country, I think, and as a nation, is absolutely fascinating to study, both about its within its own history, within its own people, and the wars and things that would have gone on that were precipitated maybe by starvation, so many different things, but also they're being invaded by others, and the Japanese doing that. And there's, again, I think that what you're presenting in the history of the book, America Invades, is you're giving different pictures, and sometimes one atom may be a good guy and the other guy may not be so good. And then it reverses.
Right. Well, as you say, we covered, as you notice in the book, I mean, we covered a lot of ground. We cover the whole world. I mean, we have a chapter on every country, and we also cover a lot of time, going back from, you know, the 18th century to more or less the present. And so we cover an awful lot of ground and time, and yet we also try, and the title is America Invades, but we tried hard to not be political, to just mm-hmm. try to lay out the facts as much as, you know, everybody has their politics, but we tried to keep that to one side, and my co-author and I don't have exactly the same politics either, so that forced us to sometimes kind of, you know, meet in the middle on when something controversial came up, but I mean, most of it, though, you know, is not most of history is not, you know, strictly partisan by any means, and usually partisanship often messes up our view of history, because we want to make, you know, grind a particular axe or something for something, and we tried to not do that with this book, to lay out the facts and let readers make up their own minds about whether they think this involvement was a good idea, a bad idea, or perhaps a bit of both.
Estonia. Now, this is a little country. Just
sure.
A little country. It's in the Baltic and not too far from St. Petersburg, and
right.
They suffered a great deal during the Second World War, and then, of course, Russia took it over.
Right.
There again, I was surprised that it was finally liberated in 1991. And
right.
The state of Maryland, the National Guard there, partnered with Estonia.
Right. And, of course, Estonia, that was formerly a part of the Soviet Union, now, of course, it's an independent nation. It's part of the Baltic republics of Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania. And all three of those are today, you know, members of NATO. So they are our allies.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, here you have the situation with Estonia where they're on the border of, you know, Putin's Russia. And, of course, they're all basically tiny countries that could be, you know, if a push came to shove, if Russia were to invade, it would be a very frightening situation, because, of course, NATO, that given the fact that they're NATO allies, the part of the core of NATO is that an attack on one nation is an attack on all, and that's, in fact, why, for instance, in Afghanistan, you had so many NATO countries like Britain, where I'm speaking to you from, and many others that participated in Afghan, sent soldiers in support after 9/11 to Afghanistan. And so by the same token, there's this understanding between NATO members that an attack on one is an attack on all. So if Russia were to, and, you know, if Putin were to try to swallow up Estonia, it would be a very serious situation, because we do have a formal alliance with Estonia, and also with, of course, Latvia, Lithuania as well.
France. It is because
France.
Of Lafayette and the
France,
French.
Of course, goes way back. I mean, we have had involvements.
Yes.
With France. I mean, it's really our oldest ally, I mean,
mm-hmm.
of all time. I mean, and it goes back to the American Revolution. I mean, that, as you said, Lafayette, and the French played a really important role in the American Revolution in helping the United States to become an independent nation. And so we've had a very long relationship with France, and usually a very close and friendly relationship with France, and that, of course, extended into the 20th century. We fought two world wars together with France. You had the complication in World War II of the fact that they were initially defeated and were occupied, and you had Vichy France. But we did, of course, play a very important role on June 6, 1944, with the landings at Normandy for D-Day. That was the beginning of the liberation of continental France. And of course, I mean, if you go to D-Day today, you'll see, of course, the graveyards where so many soldiers, of course, died in France in both World Wars, and many are buried there to this day. And you'll see, things like, and we have photographs in the book too, from Normandy, a number of pictures included from Normandy, to kind of pay tribute to the extraordinary sacrifice that was made by American and other Allied troops with the liberation of France in World War II.
There were 134,000 American soldiers that died there. And yes, I really appreciated the photographs and the information, but also I'd never heard of Clipperton Island, and this was associated with France. Clipperton right. Island, why is that so significant?
Well, it's funny. It's this guano island, and I think it's in off the coast of South America, I believe, or something. There was this funny little footnote at the end of the French chapter about this island that had a French connection, and that the United States and the State Department had it become French. But then during World War II, we returned. FDR, the president, was President Roosevelt was worried that it might be used when, of course, France was occupied by the Germans and there was Vichy France. They thought that it might become kind of an Axis outpost in the New World, and so there were like troops that were sent to occupy the island and to raise the American flag on this tiny island, Clipperton Island, which basically was Guan. I mean, where it's an island that usually belonged to the seabirds that got taken over by the U.S. Army briefly in World War II.
Amazing. Grenada has been in the news off and on through the years,
right.
And it is a significant location. And you state in your information that it was the site of America's largest military intervention since the Vietnam War, and that was in 1983.
Right. That's right. During the Reagan administration, there was, and this was shortly, okay, it was 1983, so it's only a couple years after the seizure of the hostages in Iran, which made Americans, of course, very nervous about the idea of hostages being seized. And Grenada was this island in the Caribbean that, and it had a school, a medical school there, and there were a lot of American students at the medical school. And there was fear that these students might become hostages, because Grenada was this country where you had a somewhat of a leftist guy who was actually killed by more extreme left, by communists, and he was something of a dictator, but he was taken over by Grenada was taken over by these kind of revolutionary communists who they were bringing Cubans to the island, and they were building an air base on the island, and so there was a great deal of concern this is during the Cold War, and so there was this invasion of Grenada, and that took place in 83. Vietnam, there was of course a lot of concern in the military about the status of the military and the ability of the U.S. military after Vietnam, and Grenada, they was kind of this kind of indication that the U.S. military could actually kind of get the job done, where they were able to invade and to seize the island in a very short time, and to capture the Cubans and basically kind of rescue the potential hostages from the school. The one thing I think that's really interesting as a kind of footnote to Grenada is the connection with Thanksgiving, because obviously, of course, we Americans celebrate Thanksgiving every year in the fall, but the Grenada has its own national Thanksgiving Day, and it's celebrated on October 25th, which is actually the day that the Americans' forces first arrived in Grenada, and so that's their national Thanksgiving, which continues as a tradition to this day.
Hungary is absolutely a beautiful land. It many times was called the breadbasket of Europe. And it was described that way. At least some friends of mine that went to visit Hungary said that the food that was there was absolutely amazing. And when the Russians took over Hungary, it created such a furor because the United States did not get engaged in defending the Hungarians. But President Eisenhower at the time said he didn't want to risk World War III. So right. The stories about the Hungarian people fighting against tanks with their bare hands and little tiny right. Molotov cocktails remains very vivid in the minds of those people that still remember it. Now, sure. Hungary, the people in Hungary suffered tremendously because when Absolutely. The Russians took over, they were starving. Yes. And yes. all the food out of Hungary was going into Russia. Mm-hmm. So it was very, very difficult. And we did not get engaged in that, but you presented some interesting information. You talk about André Friedman, who ended up taking on a different name of Robert Capa, was one of the greatest mm-hmm. war photographers of all times.
Right. Right. He became, that's right. He was a Hungarian citizen, and he ended up, you know, immigrating to the United States. Actually, of course, there's a long tradition. There are lots of Hungarians who have come to the United States. I mean, many refugees after 1956 came. But Capa came much earlier, and he became really probably, I would say, the most famous war photographer of all time. And he is, I mean, he was there on, we mentioned D-Day, June 6, 1944. And one of the ways that we remember and can get in touch with what happened on D-Day is through, and was Capa's photographs, because he was actually there that day, took photographs, some of which were not able to be developed because they had technical issues and things like that, but some of them were. And so, like, if your listeners recall Saving Private Ryan, when Spielberg was putting together that movie, he relied very heavily, and you can see it in the, there's a direct correspondence between the opening 20 minutes of Saving Private Ryan and those Capa photographs, which are really kind of one of the most authentic, you know, images of the way that we remember what happened on D-Day in 1944. So, and Capa he was actually attached. He was a photographer, of course, and he was actually attached to the U.S. Army, and he took pictures in an official capacity. And he was there also for instance, the liberation of Paris, which it was in August of 44. Capa was, you know, rolling in on an American tank at that time too. So yeah, you do have this interesting connection between the Hungarian Robert Capa and the U.S. Army.
Iran, the Middle East is in the news almost daily. It has sure. been for a long, long time. People have mixed emotions. The cultural history of that nation goes back thousands of years, as so many areas of the Middle East do. I was surprised to find out about a man by the name of Howard Baskerville, who was killed at the age of 24 in 1909.
Right.
He was killed by a sniper, but he's honored in Iran. Why?
Right, right. I believe he was a volunteer. I think he was a teacher at the school in Tabriz in Iran, and he was a volunteer who fought with the Iranians they were trying to bring some kind of a constitutional government to the country back. And we're talking about the beginning of the 20th century. And this American, who is from Nebraska, is honored today as a hero for Iran. But of course, he was American. So I think that the book is kind of filled with things that are, I think, surprising connections between. I mean, Iran. Many people think of as the enemy and so forth. But we have these old, sometimes ancient, you know, much older historic connections, mm-hmm. and Howard Baskerville is one of these.
Also, you mentioned that Iran, after the Second World War, was the fourth largest oil exporter in the world, and
right.
it supplied 90% of Europe's petroleum. It's things like this that make us aware that relationships, just like relationships between people, you can have long associations and they can go sour or they can blossom into something good. And of course, in 79, there were the American hostages seized in Tehran.
Right.
And right. the CIA was engaged in that. And then there was another tragedy that you said brought the Iran-Iraq war to an end, and that was the shooting down by the USS Vincennes on July 3rd, 1988, an Iranian commercial jetliner with 290 passengers.
Right. I mean, this is an event that's of course, much better remembered in Iran than in the United States. I mean, it was, from everything I can tell, it was an accident. It was an honest mistake. There was a ship with, you know, a jetliner flying out of Iran, and it was shot down by a missile fired from a ship from the USS Vincennes, and the United States government paid compensation as a result of this mistake, this tragedy. But it's, I mean, so yes, I mean, unfortunately, things like this happen. I mean, there were shooting downs, jetliners, Korean jetliners, by Soviet planes during the Cold War took place. And, of course, there was a lot of fear at the time, like, what does this mean? Was there something intentional behind it, you know, and all of that? I think that, you know, in the final analysis, this event with the Vincennes is similar to those things with airspace, because where basically mistakes got made. I mean, there you've got young men who sometimes have a hair trigger, and of course the United States had in 1988 there had been difficulties in the Middle East before. There had been the history with the hostages and so forth. So it was a tortured relationship between the United States and Iran to begin with, and then you have an unfortunate situation that took place then.
Kiribati. I had never even heard of this. Where is Kiribati? And who even would imagine that seaweed is going to be their major export from their country? And then all of a sudden, there it is. It's associated with Tarawa. Now, Tarawa I became aware of because of a gentleman by the name of Leon Cooper, who not only did a film about Tarawa, which was horrific. The story about Tarawa is in American Annals relative to military history. It was just a horrible, horrible sacrifice of thousands and thousands of American lives. And the Japanese were on the island of Tarawa, and that in and of itself is a story. But Kiribati is actually an island nation in the Pacific. Who knew? I mean, this is amazing.
That's right. And you're right that most people haven't heard of Kiribati, but which is an island nation in the Pacific. But of course, people have heard of Tarawa, where you had this incredible battle that was fought in World War II with the Marines going in, and that was occupied by the Japanese soldiers, and it was a brutal fight for Tarawa. In World War II, almost every side at some point. You know, obviously every side won battles and lost battles, but in the most cases when a nation lost, and this happened to America too, I mean, we surrendered, and of course there were prisoners of war in Germany, prisoners of war that the Japanese captured. They captured many Americans, particularly in the Philippines. But the exception was that the Japanese basically, as a rule, did not surrender, and that they fought to the last rather than ever giving up. And that was true at Tarawa and many of the islands in the Pacific in World War II.
Libya.
Sure. Libya, of course, we've had interesting relations. You had Muammar Gaddafi, of course, famously, who was the kind of the strong man of Libya after World War II, right up until, I think it was 2011, that he was killed by one of his own people. Libya... And before that, I mean, Americans fighting in Libya goes back much longer than that. Not just, yes, there was fighting in Libya in World War II, but even in 1801, in the beginning of the 19th century, you had Jefferson who sent, Thomas Jefferson sent troops to Libya to deal with situations with where hostages had been taken. There was a ship that was captured by some of these pirates operating, Barbary pirates operating from North Africa. And you had this marine expedition that was actually fighting in Libya. And of course that goes back to the famous marine song, which is, you know, from the hills of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli. And Tripoli in Libya, of course, is where the Marines ended up fighting I believe 1803, at the beginning of the 18th century, though. So,
mm-hmm.
Of the 19th century, sorry.
Luxembourg is not a country that many people would even be aware of, but
right.
Yet they're big in the financial industry.
Right.
And we have NATO's AWACS fleet registered
right.
in Luxembourg, but I knew that General Patton in 1945 was involved in an automobile accident and eventually died from it. But the information you give about this is that it happened in Luxembourg itself.
Well, that's right. I mean, I actually, just last year, I happened to visit Luxembourg, and there's a Luxembourg American cemetery, which is filled with American soldiers that served. Many of them were killed during the Battle of the Bulge, which was the largest land battle fought by Americans in World War II. And of course, Patton, this was, you know, maybe Patton's greatest moment of triumph when he kind of liberated. Bastogne had been surrounded by the Germans, and the town had been surrounded, and Germans were hoping they would surrender, and of course the defenders famously said nuts and refused to surrender. But it was Patton that actually was able to, with his armored troops, the Third Army Unit, to liberate Bastogne and to rescue the paratroopers, the 101st Airborne that was trapped in there. But so many of them are buried in Luxembourg today. Many of those who were killed are buried there, and of course one of those is Patton himself. And Patton insisted he had two requests. When he broke his neck after the car accident, and he had two requests. One was that the chauffeur that was driving him not be punished. I think he was a young kid, like a 19-year-old private in the army that mm-hmm. was driving him. And the other request was that he be buried with his troops in Europe, not have his body repatriated to the United States. And so you can find him. In fact, I did. I went to his grave just last year, and he is indeed, you know, they're basically surrounded by the troops that served with him during World War II.
Pakistan is a country that people either love or hate at this time.
Mm-hmm.
There is so much confusion, and Pakistan has been riddled with serious corruption. There's so much that's coming out about different environments, leaders, countries all over the world, including our own. And
right.
Pakistan has quite a history that is strongly associated with the Middle East. And you devote a good deal of information because of that history and how we became engaged in it on multiple levels.
Right, right. Of course, Pakistan was created relatively recently in the 20th century with the breakup of India, of the British India. First became independent from Britain, and then there was a very bloody war between Pakistan and India for the creation of Pakistan. I mean, Pakistan is Muslim, and of course, India is basically a Hindu country, and so there's, you know, substantial religious differences. And then there was one point at East Pakistan, and which became Bangladesh later too. So, and you had this kind of complicated history. And I mean, I thought that there was one of the things that was interesting was, everybody of course knows about the assassination of John F. Kennedy, and I mean, Kennedy wrote, there was at his funeral, there was the riderless horse that went down the next to the coffin when he his funeral, and that horse was actually a gift from the Pakistani government. So there kind of were these connections between Pakistan and the United States. Pakistan was an ally. I mean, India was famously in the non-aligned movement after the war, and didn't want to be associated, I mean, with either the West or with the communist side. Wanted to be in the neutral in between. But Pakistan, on the other hand, you know, chose to ally itself with the West. So that was kind of the background before, of course, what happened more recently with 9/11 and the involvement, and of course, ultimately, of course, the Osama bin Laden being killed in Pakistan by the SEAL Team 6 in, I believe it was 2011.
Syria, in the first paragraph, you make a comment about, we came very close to bombing Syria in 2013, and we've been offering the rebels support. But there's right. been a lot less military involvement with Syria than the U.S. has had with many other countries. And it's a very, very old, old country. Right. The history is phenomenal.
Right. Right. Syria, and of course, Syria is a chapter that we, you know, if we were rewriting the book today, I mean, this book came out about 4 years ago, that Syria would need an update, because, of course, we have been involved in Syria, you know, recently. I mean, in fact, last year, we fired Tomahawk missiles at Syria after the poison gas attack. Actually, I think it was the second poison gas attack on their own people that took place. So we have, you know, definitely been actively involved. And, of course, we've had special forces troops in Syria for a number of years fighting as well. So we definitely have been clearly involved in Syria, you know, even in recent times. And, of course, we have special forces there today as well.
Tonga. Now, I don't think most people ever in a history class hear about Tonga. And to find out that they had a king that was a graduate of the U.S. Naval War College. Now, that kind of information just would not be common knowledge. Tonga is an incredibly interesting location.
Right, right. Yes. No, I thought it was interesting that you have these connections between, you know, people from countries that so few of us have even heard about. But Tonga's king has a king. It is a monarchy in Tonga today. His name is Tupu the Sixth. Is actually a graduate of the U.S. Naval War College. I mean, it's interesting that people come to the United States to learn about military science. And of course, this gentleman happened to be one of those. But then he went back and, of course, became, probably he was crown prince when he came to the United States, and now, but today he's the king. So you have all kinds of connections like that. The king of Thailand, who died just recently, the former king of Thailand, was actually born in Boston, as well. So, because his father happened to be studying at Harvard beforehand. So you have these kind of connections. But yeah, no, Tonga is another, you know, country that we've had, you know, connections with Tonga as well.
When you were putting this book together, you were perfectly open, along with Stuart, to put out information about mistakes that the U.S. has made and also the humanitarian efforts that have been done. And to me, that kind of a discourse is very, very important when it comes to history. And I respect what the two of you decided to do, to put aside your partisan attitudes and just deal with facts to the best of your capacity. Your book, America Invades, gives such an insight into the global participation that the United States evolved into and is very much actively engaged with now. And this is very important. And you and Stuart state that some people around the world see us as a bully, as imperialists, as, you know, people that want to take over the world. We're, yes, we've acquired some territories, but the U.S. overall has gone in, like with the Second World War, and we didn't necessarily say, we want what you've got. We actually right. went in and instigated or implemented the Marshall Plan, which helped right. Japan rebuild, Europe rebuild, and we rebuilt ourselves.
Right.
So for you and Stuart as writers, how did this historical research affect the two of you?
Let's see. I think it affected us each in different ways. I mean, I felt that it was important for me to, I mean, explore, you know, my family history, to explore, to get to understand America's role around the world, and not just kind of in the things that we hear about with, from, you know, Hollywood and the more, you know, the things, I mean, people know about Normandy, but they don't know about, you know, Kiribati or something like that. I mean, there are other more obscure things that I think are interesting that need some attention as well. So, but I do think that America, yes, we do have been, we are a superpower, and we have been involved in the, in around the world. And of course, you know, we are not a perfect nation, but I would say that there are many instances, though, where if we had not done what we had done, the world would be a much darker place. And I think, you know, obviously in terms of things like Normandy and our involvement in World War II, that had things not gone the Allies' way in World War II, the world would, I think, unquestionably be a much darker place. I mean, a year after Normandy, for instance, the genocide, the Holocaust that was initiated by the Nazis was brought to an end. And that wouldn't have taken place, or would have taken much longer and been more costly had it not been for American involvement. So, and also I think about the world, the way that Europe, I mean, Europe is this kind of blood-soaked continent, I mean, that has been fighting, having internecine battles and wars for thousands of years. And, in the 19th century, you had Napoleonic Wars, you had two world wars, in the 20th century, but it's been going on for a very long time. But, I mean, since World War II, Europe has basically been at peace. And, of course, I think a lot of that, that America deserves a lot of credit for the peace that has broken out and been maintained in Europe for really a very long time now.
Christopher Kelly, I know you are in London. I so appreciate your taking this time to be with me. And for those of you that would like to find out more about this very comprehensive publication, AmericaInvades.com is the website. Before I say goodbye, and Christopher Kelly, again, I look forward to having you as a guest sometime again in the future. Before I say goodbye, what I would like to do is give you a quote by Douglas L. Edmonds. How many of us are waiting for the opportunity to do something great for the betterment of our community, forgetting that the solution of the problem requires only the active, intelligent fulfillment of individual civic duty? The only things which are wrong about our government are the things which are wrong about you and me. Democracy is never a thing done. It is and always will be a goal to be achieved. It means action, not passive acquiescence in things as they are. It requires alertness to duty, a dynamic faith, a willingness to give for the good of all. It can live only as a result of loyalty and devotion to its principles expressed by daily deeds. Devotion to principles expressed by daily deeds. Liberty and peace, democracy, whatever word you want to emphasize, is a word. These are words. The only way those words have power is when we can absolve ignorance, fear, and superstition. This is not done easily. We have many cultures in this world. All of these cultures have different belief systems founded on perhaps actions, attitudes, maybe even wars that ancestors have gone through. We're in the positioning of power today, We're in the positioning of power where we can make a difference and make peace a reality on levels that our ancestors could never have imagined. And that is what I think this programming brings to you.
This is Donna Sebo. Thank you for joining me and my guests for this dynamic and informational hour. Tell your friends and family about the program. We look forward to having you join us again. Have a magnificent and free life.